at the beginning of Canto 10, they're just inside now the walls of the city of Dis after the very traumatic attempt to get through the gates, and witnessing the tremendous power of the angel. And they look out before them and see a grey countryside, but now with flames shooting out of the ground. And Dante looks again and sees that there are scatterings of tombs everywhere, open with the heat intensely rising out from them. And he's intrigued. He wants to know, he wants to see inside them. And as ever, this isn't just about, as it were, taking notes or everyday curiosity. Seeing always means trying to understand as well. And so the beginning of the canto is set up with us expecting or wondering quite what Dante is now going to be able to see and understand with his inner eye. It's signalled in another quite peculiar way, that it's said at the beginning, at the end of the last canto, that they turned right. So they're now travelling to the right, which they do for this canto now, Canto 10. And it's exceptional, only happens one other time in Hell, that they don't follow the usual path of left, going left. And if you remember right from the start, I described the journey through Hell as like entering a labyrinth where you can't make wrong turnings. It can feel like you're getting closer, moving further away, a lost, nearly at your destination. That's what a labyrinth is like. But you can't make a mistake if, as it were, you follow God's way. So turning right is peculiar here. My sense is it fits into the story because, if you remember from before, Virgil has said to Dante that he has tracked this path previously, although he followed the guidelines of the necromancer. So someone who wasn't following God's way but had discerned his own way through Dis. And I think that business of discerning your own way and how they take that path now, unusually, is another clue as to what this canto is going to be about. It's usually described as the encounter with the heretics. And again, in sort of Heretics 101, that means not believing the right things, believing the wrong things, insisting, you might say, on the wrong things. But in a more subtle way, this kind of inner meaning of it is that you are committed to your own way, that you lose track even of God's way. Dante and Virgil do that a bit in this canto, and they encounter people who have done that so much that they now find themselves in hell, unable, in fact, to return to God's way, you might say. To the true path that can lead to fullness of life. And so they find themselves stuck in hell. But it's interesting that they nonetheless take a bit of a divergence from God's way. And I think that's important too, because a little bit of heresy, a little bit of finding your own way, testing it out, actually enables you to own for yourself God's way. If, as it were, you were just told always to do this, do that, do the other, you'd just be a kind of puppet. I wouldn't be able to share in the destination. But because you have to struggle yourself, and maybe make wrong turnings to some degree, because you're following your own volition, you're testing out your own sense of things, but recognizing when that goes off track. I think a little bit of heresy, if you like, is okay when it enables you to see more clearly the true path. So that's how I understand this note that they turn right at the beginning of at the end of the last canto through this canto, and then in fact it says at the end of Canto 10 that they turn left, as it were, back onto the usual divine way, and that deviation, which you might say in itself. Isn't initially disastrous, is I think partly what enables Dante to see more in this canto and to encounter the individuals who really have gone off from the path and so are completely lost. There's another way that shows up in the exchanges between Dante and Virgil that is pretty fascinating for its own right, but also, of course, carries meaning, has a deeper symbolism, as all things do. And that's how Dante is keeping a wish to himself, a wish to know something in this circle of hell. He's keeping that to himself, but Virgil knows of that wish. And Virgil says to Dante, you know, I know that you're keeping this wish to yourself. It creates a sense of Dante holding on something, again, that's a bit illicit, that's a bit, he's a bit guarded about. Although he says to Virgil, I'm only not telling you because you previously told me not to speak too soon. So it's a nice combo because Dante is partly guarded, but he's also learning. He's also learning not to speak too soon, as he had done previously. Do you remember when Virgil had told him off and he'd hung his head in shame? So there's that sort of just sense of struggle between the two of them. It leads them to their first heretics that they encounter, and these are the Epicureans. It was said, didn't believe in the immortality of the soul. They believed that when you die, your soulful atoms, like your material atoms, kind of return to the great atomic mush of the cosmos. And so you, as an individual, lose the possibility of immortality. That's, as it were, the kind of heresy 101 belief that they don't have. But again, it's got a sort of implicit meaning, which their commitment to that belief leads them towards. And that is a kind of self-sufficiency in Epicureanism. The surviving letters of Epicurus tell us that Epicurus told one of his friends who he's writing to not rely on his friends, but to cultivate self-sufficiency, self-reliance within himself. And if you like, that's the kind of existential aspect of not believing in the immortality of the soul. To believe that your soul is immortal is to believe that your life beyond death will somehow be sustained by the divine as well. Whereas if you cut that off, then it leads to the idea that somehow you've got to make something of the one life that you've got. No one else, as it were, can really make it for you. That kind of Epicureanism is quite common, I think, now. People who don't believe in life after death will often say you've got to make something of this life. That's where this life's meaning comes from, even, that you can make something of it yourself. Well, it's understandable in one way, but the encounter with the Epicureans here in hell signals that whilst it may seem even noble to some degree, it's a very risky strategy because, as it were, you might become so convinced that there's no life after this life, so convinced that this focus now is what counts, that you lose the capacity to experience a life after this life in God's way. And so, as it were, like the Epicureans in hell, end up with all being lost. It's also very interesting because that attitude is precisely the opposite of what Dante has just experienced when they were stranded before the city gates of Dis, that it did precisely take divine power to let them through the gates of Dis, that they had to realise how they couldn't be self-reliant, that their self-sufficiency was not going to be enough. And it was a deeply painful and traumatic moment. You know, Dante really falls apart, as you'll recall. But that moment, as it were, even without realizing that they had to fall upon God's intervention, God's sustaining power, with the angel appearing, that enabled them to get in touch with this deeper aspect of reality, this deeper side of things, which they wouldn't have known if they just relied on themselves. And in a way, that's what the Epicureans, with their belief, their heretical belief, can never really fully know, that there is a deeper power that they can rely on that can take them through even the most traumatic parts of life. Then something seemingly quite different happens. A chap pops up from one of the tombs. He's heard Dante speak, recognises the Tuscan accent, and well, it says actually he rises out of the grave, and the image is described quite precisely that he rises just to his waist, so that Dante sees him from the waist up, and it's, I think, a kind of mock resurrection that this chap is enacting. It's said that he looks then scornfully on the rest of hell. He looks very proud, you know, as if he's managed to rise himself. There's also in the commentary the observation that this chap looks a bit like the Man of Sorrows, as is described in the Hebrew Bible. And of course, he's not a man of sorrows. He's a man full of pride and scorn. So that tells you something about how this chap we're about to encounter has a different kind of self-sufficiency, self-reliance. It's one driven by his sense of his own specialness, his sense of his pride. And so the implication is that has he cut himself off from a deeper capacity to take in the power of the divine, to be porous to that, you might say. Very interesting moment that Dante is initially scared by the appearance of this chap, and draws close to Virgil, but Virgil says, no, you go and talk to him yourself. He pushes him away, and this is the first time in the Inferno that not just Virgil has left Dante on his own, which he just did previously, but now has said, no, you go and talk to this person, but choose your words carefully, he says. And the implication is that Virgil, as a good teacher, is now forcing, actually, Dante, but asking Dante to begin to try and find his own way, to make his mistakes, you might say, to risk even a bit of heresy. And Dante, sure enough, does fumble and is quite intimidated by the encounter. But nonetheless, it's kind of an important new step for him to take. It turns out that this chap is called Farinata, and he is a leading figure in the warfare in Florence in the generation before Dante. He was a leader of the Ghibellines, whereas you'll remember Dante was from the Guelph side. And their exchange is a lot about the conflict in Dante's in the generation before Dante. And Farinata says, you know, taunts Dante really, and says, you know, I expelled your side not once but twice. And Dante retorts back. He says, oh yes, but you know, we returned twice, you know, so you didn't actually defeat us after all. There's sparring between them, but this talk of return, it turns out, is a sensitive subject for Dante, because it's not just about what happened to the Guelphs, but it's raising the possibility about his own personal return to Florence, which he's about to find out from Farinata is going to be severely questioned. Farinata then, as it were, in another retort, makes a prophecy and says to Dante, you know, in 50 sons, in a period of time, you're going to realise that the art of return is a lot harder than perhaps you think. And this really starts to trouble Dante. But something else happens before that moment, in fact, because the conversation with Farinata, him half out of this tomb, the flames burning, as it were, Dante feeling intimidated, but wanting to sort of try and have a conversation about things that really matter to him. That conversation is interrupted because another figure, at least the head of another figure, appears out of the same tomb as well. This is another aspect of hell, which is going to become more and more common, that the way that the souls are stacked into tombs, much like they've been kind of laid in the mud in the higher reaches of hell. Another chap appears, and Dante recognises him. He's a chap called Cavalcante, and he's the father of a chap called Guido, who was another poet and contemporary of Dante. In fact, Guido and Dante were friends, although they had a falling out. And Cavalcante asks Dante, I hear you, this genius poet, walking into hell, but if you're here, then presumably that means my son is here too, because of his own genius. The father, sort of rather a bit like a doting father, you might say now, loving the genius of his own son, assumes that the two of them must be there together. There's one genius poet here, so my son, as it were, must be in his company. And this, raises another kind of pride, which is the pride in someone else, rather than taking your own kind of rightful self-respect. If Farinata and the Epicureans had been too much self-reliance, then the implication that Cavalcanti's fault is that he doesn't have enough self-respect. Instead, as it were, he's rather given up his life in the life of his son, the genius poetry of his son. And so when he doesn't see, this is underlined because when he doesn't see his son with Dante, and Dante recognizes Cavalcante and says, "Ah, you were expecting to meet the one who scorned me because of their falling out." Cavalcante immediately thinks that this means that his son is in deep trouble, that he is not, as it were, with the living poet, but has died, and so presumably is another part of hell that doesn't even really know about. And it causes him immediately to drop back into the coffin. As it were, the implication is he hasn't even got the strength of Farinata to stay up and hear Dante's answer properly. Such is his lack of self-respect. We're called, I think, you might put it like this, that it's even a heresy not to respect yourself. If we're made in the divine image, to give that up, as it were, and see only that genius, that image, even in your son, that too can cause you to lose the path, to fall away from the divine path. In a way, Cavalcanti is saying, I've given up trying to live my own life. I'm living it now through my son. And so he's completely traumatized when his son is not there with Dante, presumably in another part of hell. That life hasn't worked for him either. He's a pathetic figure against Farinata's proud figure, and you get the sense that Dante, although in a sort of stumbling way, is beginning to find the path between the two, sort of drawing on God's strength, relying on Virgil, but nonetheless making something of it himself. Cavalcanti falls back into the tomb, and Farinata, it's said, continues almost without kind of skipping a beat. He's not remotely interested in the person that he shares the tomb with. And they carry on sparring about Florence and what's going to happen in the future. Farinata makes this very interesting remark at this point. He's so proud and that he's preoccupied with his own reputation and how his Ghibelline fellows might have let him down. And he says that they might have let him down torments me even more than that I'm here in hell. Now, that in a way is impossible. What can be worse than being tormented in hell? But it tells you something, I think, about the psychology of that leads the soul to be lost in hell. That hell, in this case, kind of is of his own making, because he is so preoccupied with his own reputation. And so, hence saying that that's actually stings him more than the flames which are burning round about. Well, the flames that are burning round about really are the flames of his injured reputation. He looks stuck here for all eternity. Dante then realizes that he might have caused some pain to to Cavalcante, and by not assuring Cavalcante that actually his son was still living that he wasn't yet in hell, that his fate, as it were, wasn't yet decided. And he asks Farinata to communicate that to Cavalcante when he goes back down into the tomb. We presume that Farinata would do no such thing. He doesn't really seem to have even noticed that Cavalcante was there. And so there's a sense that Dante is left with the guilt of his mistake, combined with his sort of compassion for the soul in hell. And again, you know, that's a sort of painful state to be in, but it's one that is important to be able to tolerate, to be able to recognise your own mistakes, and yet not fall into despair. Because, and again, in a way, that is to lose track of the way. It's not to respect yourself enough. It's to, as it were, fall into the risk that the heretics fully make when they just follow their own way and lose track of the path. And as if to underline that, Dante asks Farinata about more of the souls that are in this state. We're given a couple of names, nothing much more is explored about that. But again, there's a sense that Dante is kind of learning. Do you remember, you know, to give something a name is to be able to differentiate between things that otherwise look quite similar. So, you know, there are different kinds of heresy. There are different kinds of ways of straying from the path and the risk that becomes permanent, and which he's grappling with here. But Farinata drops back down into the tomb, and Dante is left worrying, partly about what's happened, but I think also about this prophecy which Farinata's given him about his own future. This sense that within 50 suns he too is going to know how difficult it is to return to Florence. And Virgil notices him fixating on this, worrying about it, and kind of tells him off. This is the last thing he has to learn in this canto, and gives him the warning that if you fixate too much on the future, which you think you've been given some glimpse of, some sense of, then you'll also be like these souls in hell, who, as we're learning, you know, are either preoccupied with the past or fixated on the future, which they get glimpses of in this strange state. But they aren't able to attend to the present. And Virgil tells Dante that, look, what's happening is what's happening now. And if you don't pay attention to that, if you don't really let yourself experience and be changed by what's happening here and now, then you'll stay on this wrong path and you'll miss actually the pathway to the destination that God otherwise wills for you. And Virgil at this point reminds Dante that they're there because of the love of Beatrice and Lucia, and also the Virgin Mary. That's the present that Dante must try and pay attention to. And as if to underline it, at that point that Dante, the poet, tells us, they turned left once more, as it were, they moved off the heretical path. For all that it was helpful to learn something from doing that, primarily because Dante is able to make the path now his own, not just the one that's kind of ordained and that he would be forced along as if a puppet. He's able to get enough sense now that he must make that path his own. And so with that bit more will, that bit more understanding, and that bit more love and desire, though it's painful with the guilt, he and Virgil continue through more deeply into hell. This plain just by the castle of Dis, it said, you know, was a kind of countryside of flames and tombs. It's almost like a kind of vestibule to the deeper hell that they're now about to enter. And the canto ends with them coming across an unbearable stench that causes them to stand stock still.